Rule 7. Work as hard as you possibly can on at least one thing and see what happens. The value of heat and pressure. When coal is subjected to intense heat and pressure far below the Earth's surface, its atoms rearrange themselves into the perfect repeating crystalline alignment characterizing a diamond. The carbon that makes up coal also becomes maximally durable in its diamond form, as diamond is the hardest of all substances. Finally, it becomes capable of reflecting light. This combination of durability and glitter gives a diamond the qualities that justify its use as a symbol of value. That which is valuable is pure, properly aligned, and glitters with light. And this is true for the person just as it is for the gem. Light, of course, signifies the shining brilliance of heightened and focused consciousness. Human beings are conscious during the day when it is light. Much of that consciousness is visual and therefore dependent on light. To be illumined or enlightened is to be exceptionally awake and aware, to attain a state of being commonly associated with divinity. To wear a diamond is to become associated with the radiance of the sun, like the king or queen whose profile is stamped on the sun-like disk of the gold coin, a near-universal standard of worth. Heat and pressure transform the base matter of common coal into the crystalline perfection and rare value of the diamond. The same can be said of a person. We know that the multiple forces operating in the human soul are often not aligned with one another. We do the things we wish we would not do, and do not do the things we know we should do. We want to be thin, but we sit on the couch eating Cheetos and despairing. We are directionless, confused, and paralyzed by indecision. We are pulled in all directions by temptations, despite our stated will, and we waste time, procrastinate, and feel terrible about it. But we do not change. It was for such reasons that archaic people found it easy to believe that the human soul was haunted by ghosts, possessed by ancestral spirits, demons, and gods, none of whom necessarily had the best interests of the person at heart. Since the time of the psychoanalysts, these contrary forces, these obsessive and sometimes malevolent spirits, have been conceptualized psychologically as impulses, emotions, or motivational states, or as complexes which act like partial personalities united within the person by memory but not by intent. Our neurological structure is indeed hierarchical. The powerful instinctual servants at the bottom, governing thirst, hunger, rage, sadness, elation, and lust, can easily ascend and become our masters and just as easily wage war with one another. The resilience and strength of a united spirit is not easy to attain. A house divided against itself, proverbially, cannot stand. Likewise, a poorly integrated person cannot hold himself together when challenged. He loses union at the highest level of psychological organization. He loses the properly balanced admixture of properties that is another feature of the well-tempered soul and cannot hold himself together. We know this when we say, he lost it, or he just fell apart. Before he picks up the pieces and rearranges them, such a person is likely to fall prey to domination by one or more partial personalities. This might be a spirit of rage or anxiety or pain leaping in to occupy the person when his temper is lost. You can see this occurring most clearly in the case of a 2-year-old having a tantrum. He has lost himself temporarily and is for the moment pure emotion. This is an occurrence that is often deeply upsetting to the 2-year-old himself, and one of an intensity that would be terrifying to beholders if manifested by an adult. The archaic motivational systems governing anger merely push the toddler's developing personality aside and have their way with his mind and actions. This is a true and unfortunate defeat for the still fragile centralizing ego, struggling against powerful forces toward psychological and social integration. Lack of internal union also makes itself known in the increased suffering, magnification of anxiety, absence of motivation, and lack of pleasure that accompany indecision and uncertainty. The inability to decide among 10 things, even when they are desirable, is equivalent to torment by all of them. Without clear, well-defined, and non-contradictory goals, the sense of positive engagement that makes life worthwhile is very difficult to obtain. Clear goals limit and simplify the world as well, reducing uncertainty, anxiety, shame, and the self-devouring physiological forces unleashed by stress. The poorly integrated person is thus volatile and directionless, and this is only the beginning. Sufficient volatility and lack of direction can rapidly conspire to produce the helplessness and depression characteristic of prolonged futility. This is not merely a psychological state. The physical consequences of depression, often preceded by excess secretion of the stress hormone cortisol, are essentially indistinguishable from rapid aging. Weight gain, cardiovascular problems, diabetes, cancer, and Alzheimer's. The social consequences are just as serious as the biological. A person who is not well put together overreacts to the slightest hint of frustration or failure. He cannot enter into productive negotiations, even with himself, because he cannot tolerate the uncertainty of discussing potential alternative futures. He cannot be pleased, because he cannot get what he wants, and he cannot get what he wants because he will not choose one thing instead of another. He can also be brought to a halt by the weakest of arguments. One of his multiple warring subpersonalities will latch on to such arguments, often contrary to his best interest, and use them in the form of doubts to buttress its contrarian position. A deeply conflicted person can therefore be stopped, metaphorically, with the pressure of a single finger exerted on his chest, even though he may lash out against such an obstacle. To move forward with resolve, it is necessary to be organized, to be directed towards something singular and identifiable. Aim. Point. All this is part of maturation and discipline, and something to be properly valued. If you aim at nothing, you become plagued by everything. If you aim at nothing, you have nowhere to go, nothing to do, and nothing of high value in your life, as value requires the ranking of options and sacrifice of the lower to the higher. Do you really want to be anything you could be? Is that not too much? Might it not be better to be something specific, and then perhaps to add to that? Would that not come as a relief, even though it is also a sacrifice? The worst decision of all. When I was in graduate school at McGill University in Montreal, studying for my clinical PhD, I noticed a pronounced improvement in character in everyone who continued in the progressively more difficult 5 to 6 year program. Their social skills improved. They became more articulate. They found a profound sense of personal purpose. They served a useful function in relation to others. They became more disciplined and organized. They had more fun. This was all despite the fact that the graduate courses were often of lower quality than they might have been, the clinical placements unpaid and difficult to come by, and the relationships with graduate supervisors sometimes, but by no means always, subpar. Those beginning graduate work were often still immature and confused. But the discipline imposed upon them by the necessity of research, and, more particularly, thesis preparation, soon improved their characters. To write something long, sophisticated, and coherent means, at least in part, to become more complex, articulate, and deeper in personality. When I became a professor and started mentoring undergraduate and graduate students, I observed the same thing. The undergrad psychology students who allied themselves with a lab, and therefore took on additional work, obtained better grades than those who burdened themselves less. Taking on the functions of junior researchers helped them establish a place and a community while requiring them to discipline themselves, not least by necessitating more efficient use of their time. I observed a similar process when working as a clinical psychologist. I typically encouraged my clients to choose the best path currently available to them, even if it was far from their ideal. This sometimes meant tolerating at least a temporary decrease in ambition or in pride, but had the advantage of substituting something real for something available only in fantasy. Improvements in mental health almost invariably followed. Is there anything worth committing to? I am now old enough to have seen what happens when the various manners in which this question might be answered manifest themselves. In my career as undergraduate, graduate student, professor, clinical psychologist, researcher, and in my various additional forays, I have seen the same twin paths of development manifest themselves repeatedly. Both are available, in principle, to everyone, to each of the half-developed, wandering, prematurely cynical, questioning, doubtful, and hopeful fools that we all are to varying degrees when young and on the brink of adulthood. It has become self-evident to me that many commitments have enduring value, those of character, love, family, friendship, and career, foremost among them, and perhaps in that order. Those who remain unable or unwilling to establish a well-tended garden, so to speak, in any or all those domains, inevitably suffer because of it. However, commitment requires its pound of flesh. To pursue an undergraduate degree means sacrifice and study, and the choice of a given discipline means foregoing the possibility of other pathways of study. The same goes for selecting a partner or group of friends. Cynicism about such things, or mere indecision or doubt, finds an easy but truly adversarial ally in the mindlessly nihilistic rationality that undermines everything. Why bother? What difference is it going to make in 1,000 years? What makes one pathway preferable to another, or to none, anyway? It is possible to be content, or even happy, with one partner or another, or with one group of friends or another, or with one career or another. In some sense, the satisfaction that these arrangements bring could have been generated by different choices. They are also each deeply flawed. Romantic partners can be fickle and complex, as can friends, and every career or job is characterized by frustration, disappointment, corruption, arbitrary hierarchy, internal politics, and sheer idiocy of decision-making. We could conclude from that lack of specific or ideal value that nothing matters more than anything else, or to draw the even more hopeless allied conclusion that nothing therefore matters at all. But those who draw such conclusions, no matter how well armed they are with rationally coherent arguments, pay a high price. People suffer for it if they quit before completing an undergraduate degree or the study of a trade. And this means quit, not fail, although the two can be difficult to distinguish. Sometimes people fail because they just cannot manage the job despite good intentions and necessary discipline. It takes a certain verbal capacity to operate effectively as a lawyer, and a certain degree of facility with mechanical objects, for example, to become a carpenter. Sometimes the match between person and choice is so poor that even commitment will not suffice to bring about the desired end. But very often failure is a consequence of insufficient single-mindedness, elaborate but pointless rationalization, and rejection of responsibility. And little good comes of that. People who do not choose a job or a career commonly become unmoored and drift. They may attempt to justify that drifting with a facade of romantic rebelliousness or prematurely world-weary cynicism. They may turn to casual identification with avant-garde artistic exploration or treat the attendant despair and aimlessness with the pursuit of hardcore alcohol and drug use and their instant gratifications. But none of that makes for a successful 30-year-old, let alone someone a decade older. The same holds true for people who cannot choose and then commit to a single romantic partner, or are unable or unwilling to be loyal to their friends. They become lonely, isolated, and miserable, and all that merely adds the additional depth of bitterness to the cynicism that spurred the isolation in the first place. That is not the sort of vicious circle that you want to characterize your life. The people I knew who finished their undergraduate degrees or trade programs were better for it. Not good, necessarily. Not functioning optimally. Not necessarily thrilled with their choices or devoid of doubt and misgiving. Not even certain to continue in pursuit of what they had studied. But far better than those who withdrew and drifted. The commitments and the sacrifices thereby entailed matured those who endured and made them better people. So, what is the conclusion? There are many things to which we might commit ourselves. A case can be made for the arbitrary and even meaningless nature of any given commitment, given the plethora of alternatives, given the corruption of the systems demanding that commitment. But the same case cannot be made for the fact of commitment itself. Those who do not choose a direction are lost. It is far better to become something than to remain anything but become nothing. This is despite all the genuine limitations and disappointments that becoming something entails. Everywhere, the cynic despairs are bad decisions. But someone who has transcended that cynicism, or more accurately, replaced it with an even more profound doubt, that is, the doubt that doubt itself is an ultimately reliable guide, objects. The worst decision of all is none. Discipline and unity. The discipline that enables concentration on one thing begins young. At a very early age, children begin to order the multiplicity of emotions and motivations that constitute their basic instincts of survival into the strategies of cooperation and competition that involve others voluntarily. And children who are well constituted and fortunate manage this in a manner that is simultaneously socially desirable and psychologically healthy. When a child's self-directed experience is interrupted by the emergence of an instinctual system, when the child is hungry, angry, tired, or cold, the good parent steps in, solving the problem, disrupting the child's fragile unity, or, better yet, teaching the child to solve the problem himself. When the latter process has been completed with sufficient thoroughness, the child is ready to join the social world. This must happen by the age of 4, or it may never happen. A child must be sufficiently self-organizing to be desirable to his or her peers by the age of 4, or risk permanent social ostracism. A child who is still having temper tantrums by that age runs precisely that risk. The process of integration is furthered by peers, friends, for the child well-trained or fortunate enough to be accepted. When a child plays a game with others, she is disciplining herself. She is learning to subordinate all her competing impulses to the dictates of that game, one thing despite the potential multiplicity of rules. Learning to subjugate herself voluntarily to its rules and well-defined goals. To play in such a manner, she must transform herself into a functional subunit of a larger social machine. This can be interpreted as a sacrifice of individuality, if individuality is defined as limitless choice of impulsive gratification. But it is much more accurately development of individuality considered at a higher level. The properly functioning and integrated individual tempers the desires of the present with the necessities of the future, including the necessity of playing well with others. It is in this manner that the multifarious games of childhood temper the screaming cacophony of late infancy. The payoff for such development is, of course, the security of social inclusion and the pleasure of the game. This, it should be noted, is not repression. This point must be made clear. As people believe that the things discipline imposed by choice prevent us from doing will somehow be lost forever. It is this belief, in large part, often expressed with regard to creativity, that makes so many parents afraid of damaging their children by disciplining them. But proper discipline organizes rather than destroys. A child terrified into obedience, or shielded from every possible chance of misbehavior, is not disciplined, but abused. A child who has been disciplined properly, by contrast, by parents, other adults, and most significantly, by other children, does not battle with, defeat, and then permanently inhibit her aggression. Such a child does not even sublimate that aggression or transform it into something different. Instead, she integrates it into her increasingly sophisticated game-playing ability, allowing it to feed her competitiveness and heighten her attention, and making it serve the higher purposes of her developing psyche. A well-socialized child does not, therefore, lack aggression. She just becomes extremely good at being aggressive, transmuting what might otherwise be a disruptive drive into the focused perseverance and controlled competitiveness that make for a successful player. By the dawn of adolescence, such a child can organize herself into ever more complex games, joint, goal-directed activities that everyone plays voluntarily and that everyone enjoys and benefits from, even if only one person or one team can win at a time. This ability is civilization itself in its nascent form at the level of the individual player and group. This is where both cooperation and the opportunity to compete and win make themselves simultaneously manifest. This is all necessary preparation for the more permanent choices that must be made for a successful adulthood. It is certainly possible and reasonable to have some doubt and to argue about which game might best be played here and now, but it is not reasonable to state that all games are therefore unnecessary. Likewise, although it may be possible to argue about which morality is the necessary morality, it is not possible to argue that morality itself is thus unnecessary. Doubt about which game is appropriate right now is not relativism. It is the intelligent consideration of context. The fact that happiness is not appropriate, for example, at a funeral, does not mean that happiness itself lacks value. Likewise, the claim that morality is both necessary and inevitable is not totalitarian. It is merely the observation that basic, primitive, unidimensional values must be subsumed under socially organized structures for peace and harmony to exist and be maintained. It was the bringing together of a warring multiplicity under the unifying doctrines of Christianity that civilized Europe. It could, perhaps, have been Buddhism, Confucianism, or Hinduism, insofar as the East is also both broadly civilized and unified. But it could not have been the absence of any doctrine whatsoever. Without a game, there is no peace, only chaos. Furthermore, the game that exists must be playable, as we discussed in Rule 4. Notice that opportunity lurks where responsibility has been abdicated. This means that it must be structured by a communally acceptable set of rules, by only those constraints that many people are willing to abide by for a long time. It is possible that many such games exist, theoretically, but it is at least equally possible that there are only a few. In any case, the rules of Christianity and the rules of Buddhism are by no means arbitrary, by no means nonsensical superstition, any more than the rules of a playable game are merely arbitrary or nonsensically superstitious. To think that peace can exist without the overarching and voluntarily accepted game is to misunderstand the ever-present danger of the fragmented tribalism to which we can so easily and devastatingly regress. Once the social world has forced the child to integrate his multiple sub-personalities, he can play with others. After that, he should be ready to engage in the more serious games that make up jobs or professions with their highly structured expectations, skills, and rules. He must learn those, as well as, when older, the dance of the sexes. He must integrate his socialized personality with that of another so that the couple he makes with that other can exist together peacefully, productively, within society over the long term, while maintaining voluntary willingness to do so. This is the dual process of psychological and social integration that accompanies apprenticeship, all associated with the outsourcing of sanity. Adherence to this process will make him a socially sophisticated, productive, and psychologically healthy adult, capable of true reciprocity, and perhaps the temporary suspension of the demand of reciprocity necessary to raise children. But the story of integration and socialization does not end here. This is because two things are happening at once during an apprenticeship worthy of the name, just as learning to play a game and learning to be a good sport happen at the same time while playing. The apprentice must initially become a servant of tradition, of structure, and of dogma, just as the child who wants to play must follow the rules of the game. At its best, this servitude means grateful alliance in one form or another with the institutions typically considered patriarchal. Apprenticeship means heat and pressure, as new workmen are tried by their peers, as articling law students are tried by their employers, as medical residents are tried by physicians, nurses, and patients. The goal of this heat and pressure is subordination of an undeveloped personality, by no means individual at this point, to a single path for the purposes of transformation from undisciplined beginner to accomplished master. The master, who is the rightful product of apprenticeship, is, however, no longer the servant of dogma. Instead, he is now himself served by dogma, which he has the responsibility to maintain, as well as the right to change when change is necessary. This makes the master, who once allowed himself to be enslaved, an emergent follower of spirit, the wind, spirit, that bloweth where it listeth, John 3:8. The master can allow himself his intuitions, as the knowledge obtained by the discipline he has acquired will enable him to criticize his own ideas and assess their true value. He may, therefore, more clearly perceive the fundamental patterns or principles that underlie the dogmas of his discipline and draw inspiration from those instead of blindly adhering to the rules as currently articulated or embodied. He may even rely on the integrated union of his personality and his training to modify or transform even those more fundamental, deeply intuited principles in the service of an even higher union. Dogma and spirit. The limiting disciplines that serve both as precondition for a game and for the development of a unity of being can usefully be considered thou shalt nots, rules that highlight what is definitely not to be done, while whatever is supposed to be done is taking place. Abiding by these rules produces a development of character, character with a particular nature or essence. We have already discussed this as, say, the development of personal desirability as a player of many games or sequences of games. As is the case in many other situations, it appears that this idea is already implicit in the stories that make up the bedrock of our culture. This is particularly evident in the Gospel of Mark, which is a commentary on what are among the most influential rules of the game ever formulated, the Mosaic Ten Commandments, and, even more broadly, a commentary on rules themselves. The commandments follow. 1. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. 2. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. 3. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. 4. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 5. Honor thy father and thy mother. 6. Thou shalt not kill. 7. Thou shalt not commit adultery. 8. Thou shalt not steal. 9. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. 10. Thou shalt not covet. The first speaks to the necessity of aiming at the highest possible unity. The second, to the danger of worshipping false idols by confusing the representation or the image with the ineffable it is supposed to represent. The third means that it is wrong to claim moral inspiration from God while knowingly committing sinful acts. The fourth means that it is necessary to leave time to regularly consider what is truly valuable or sacred. The fifth keeps families together, mandating honor, respect, and gratitude from children as just reward for the sacrifices made by parents. The sixth prevents murder, obviously, but by doing so, also protects the community from potential descent into constant and potentially multi-generational feuding. The seventh mandates the sacredness of the marriage vow, predicated on the assumption, like the fifth, that the stability and value of the family is of paramount importance. The eighth allows for honest, hardworking people to reap the benefits of their efforts without fear that what they have produced will be taken from them arbitrarily, and, thereby, makes civilized society a possibility. The ninth maintains the integrity of the law, reducing or eliminating its use as a weapon. And the tenth is a reminder that envy and the resentment it breeds is a destructive force of the highest power. It is worthwhile thinking of these commandments as a minimum set of rules for a stable society, an iterable social game. The commandments are rules established in the book of Exodus and part of that unforgettable story. But they are also pointers to something else, something that simultaneously emerges from and transcends the rules and constitutes their essence. The core idea is this: subjugate yourself voluntarily to a set of socially determined rules, those with some tradition in their formulation, and a unity that transcends the rules will emerge. The unity constitutes what you could be if you concentrate on a particular goal and see it through. There's a story relevant to this idea in the Gospel of Mark. The pertinent section begins with Christ journeying to the Temple of Jerusalem, where he casts out the money changers and merchants and addresses the crowd with an irresistible charisma. And, as the tale goes, the scribes and chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him, for they feared him, because all the people was astonished at his doctrine. Mark 11:18. In consequence, they begin to conspire, questioning this strange prophet, hoping to entice him into a heretical and therefore potentially fatal statement, sending to him certain of the Pharisees and of the Herodians to catch him in his words. Mark 12:13. Christ deals masterfully, to say the least, with the questioners, reducing them to an aggrieved and resentful silence. The section ends with what is arguably the most difficult and treacherous of questions posed by a particularly cunning, but also perhaps begrudgingly admiring, interlocutor. Mark 12:28-34. And one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, and perceiving that he had answered them well, asked him, "Which is the first commandment of all?" And Jesus answered him, "The first of all the commandments is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. And the second is like, namely this: thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. There is none other commandment greater than these.' And the scribe said unto him, 'Well, Master, thou hast said the truth, for there is one God, and there is none other but he. And to love him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, and with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love his neighbor as himself, is more than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices.' And when Jesus saw that he answered discreetly, he said unto him, 'Thou art not far from the kingdom of God.' And no man after that durst ask him any question." What does this all mean? The personality integrated by disciplined adherence to a set of appropriate rules is simultaneously, although perhaps unknowingly, guided by or imitating the highest possible ideal. Precisely that ideal that constitutes whatever common element of moral makes all the rules good, just, and necessary. That ideal, according to Christ's answer, is something singular, the one Lord, thoroughly embodied, loved with all thy heart, soul, understanding, and strength, and then manifested as a love that is identical for self and all mankind. Western culture is unconsciously underpinned by a very profound drama reflecting all this because of its origin in Judeo-Christian conceptualization. Psychologically speaking, Christ is a representation or an embodiment of the mastery of dogma and the consequent emergence of spirit. Spirit is the creative force that gives rise to what becomes dogma with time. Spirit is also that which constantly transcends such time-honored tradition, when possible. It is for this reason that an apprenticeship ends with a masterpiece, the creation of which signifies not only the acquisition of the requisite skill, but the acquisition of the ability to create new skills. Although Christ commits many acts that might be considered revolutionary, as we discussed in Rule 1, he is nonetheless explicitly portrayed in the Gospels as the master of tradition, and says of himself, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill." Matthew 5:17, KJV. The New International Version of the Bible perhaps puts it more comprehensibly. "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." Christ therefore presents himself as both the product of tradition and the very thing that creates and transforms it. The same pattern of creative conflict pervades the Old Testament, which is in large part a series of stories about the Spirit in prophetic opposition to the inevitable corruption of dogma harnessed to serve power. It is the personality who mimics that model who might be regarded as truly Western in the deepest of psychological senses. If you work as hard as you can on one thing, you will change. You will start to also become one thing instead of the clamoring multitude you once were. That one thing, developed properly, is not only the disciplined entity formed by sacrifice, commitment, and concentration. It is that which creates, destroys, and transforms discipline itself, civilization itself, by expressing its unity of personality and society. It is the very word of truth upon whose function all habitable order, wrenched out of chaos, eternally depends. Work as hard as you possibly can on at least one thing, and see what happens.